Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, we are joined by authors and Bronte experts Adele Hay and Nick Holland to explore Anne Bronte's life, legacy, and her debut novel, Agnes Grey. Set against the backdrop of 19th century England, this poignant novel follows the experiences of Agnes, a governess, as she navigates the complexities of love, morality, and social class, which is argued to mirror Anne's own life. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, journey into the heart and mind of Anne Bronte and her timeless masterpiece.
Hello and good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the first of today's festival sessions about Anne Bronte. This session is entitled Parallels of Resilience and Reality, Agnes Grey and Anne Bronte. And with me on stage are Adele Hay, PhD researcher at Loughborough University, and Nick Holland, author of four Bronte biographies, and both have written brilliant biographies of Anne Bronte. So I'll be talking to Nick and Adele until around 1:40, 1:45, and then I will turn the spotlight on you for your questions. So please make a note of things as they strike you. So we'll start first with what kindled your interest in Anne from the beginning? Who would like to take this? Adele?
As with a lot of Bronte fans, I became obsessed at a very young age. They just have that effect on us. I first went to the parsonage when I was about 11 years old. Unfortunately, I was told at the time, not by anyone who works at the parsonage, that Anne Bronte was not really worth reading. You know, she wasn't as good as her sisters. She was a bit too religious, a bit morose. Don't bother. So it wasn't until I was a bit older that I started reading Anne Bronte, and I could not believe that people had said, don't bother, she's not as good. Her books are amazing. I was blown away by the subjects that she was tackling and also just her skill as a writer. So that, you know, that increased that obsession.
And what about you, Nick?
Well, I first discovered the Brontes when I was 18, so a bit older, and I went to university to do an English degree. And the first book on the reading list was Wuthering Heights. And I thought, I'm not going to like this. So I'm an 18-year-old man, as I thought then, from Barnsley. I thought, I'm not going to like this romance. This won't be up my street. And I read a first page, oh, it's not bad. And then I was just completely blown away. I read the whole thing in a few hours. And the next day I went to Haworth. I got the train to Haworth. And it started a lifelong obsession with the Brontes. That first weekend I brought Elizabeth Gaskell's biography of Charlotte, even though I'd not read any of Charlotte's work at that point. And I just spent the whole, well, really whole first semester at university just reading everything I could about the Brontes. And it just went from there. And like Adele said, you know, you hear that, oh, Anne's not as good as Charlotte or Emily. And I always liked the underdog, so well, I'm going to give Anne a chance. And then again, I just thought, wow, this writing's just as good as Charlotte or Emily's.
So obviously we have Mrs. Gaskell and Charlotte to thank for Anne's work as it first hit, you know, the readership. So how much damage or how much skewed perspective was there in terms of how Anne was perceived when she was first published? Can we take that from you first, Adele?
I've been doing a lot on this for my PhD. It's one of my special interests. After Anne died, Charlotte famously wrote a biographical notice of both of her sisters. So both Emily and Anne had died at this point, and a new edition of Wuthering Heights and Agnes Grey came out, edited by Charlotte. She also wrote a biographical notice of Emily and Anne, and she also wrote a preface to Wuthering Heights. So Charlotte Bronte is kind of all over this new edition. It's like she's presenting her sisters in a light that she's curated their personality and their reputation. And I think this was in response to a lot of really horrible reviews of both Emily and Anne. So reviewers and critics were saying, these Bell brothers, they're nasty people, they're very coarse, they love morbid subject matter, they shouldn't be writing about this kind of thing, their books are dangerous. And I think Charlotte saw that and it really did upset her. You know, she was writing to her friend Ellen and saying, it's really painful to me that they have this idea of my sisters. So she presented this new edition of their work with unpublished poems, a biographical notice that I think came from a good place, but has ultimately done quite a lot of damage to how we see Emily and Anne in particular. Charlotte wrote that she was unlearned, which we know isn't true. She didn't mention anything about Anne's, you know, work as a governess. She made them seem very insular and also very kind of, she said about Anne that she had a religious melancholy, that she didn't really talk to anyone apart from to talk about religion. So yeah, I think she unwittingly did quite a lot of damage that was then repeated by Elizabeth Gaskell and subsequent biographers.
And does that chime with your thinking, Nick?
It does, and I agree that biographical notice and then Elizabeth Gaskell's biography, which is largely based on what Charlotte had told Elizabeth. Elizabeth never met Emily or Anne. They'd already died by the time she came to know Charlotte. And I do think it damaged Anne's reputation especially. You know, Charlotte said, yeah, she's a melancholy woman. You know, writing Tenant of Wildfell Hall really drove her to the edge, in effect, she was saying. And Charlotte wrote to her publishers, Smith Elder, when they were preparing the works to be reissued. And Charlotte even said, you know, I think republishing Tenant would be a mistake. And I think that really damaged that book and Anne's reputation. It was another 10 years, really, before it came back into print. By that time, people had forgot about it, or they'd moved on from Anne Bronte. So I think it's great to see talks like this, you know, lots of people here, and the new influx, really, of Anne Bronte scholarship and Anne Bronte biographies. So I think at last, Anne's time is coming, and people are learning about her. And not just what Charlotte said, but I agree as well with Adele that, you know, Charlotte did, in a sense, you could say, belittle Anne in the biographical notice. But I think it was from a good place. It was a good intention. You know, she wanted to protect them from the, you know, criticism that the Bells had received. And I think she was very close to Anne. Well, it's clearly to me, you know, after Anne's death, how that affected Charlotte. I think she did absolutely love Anne, but I think she was overprotective of her after she died, really.
So what was the driver for your biographies then? They're both quite different, both equally compelling and enlightening. And I do, anyone who hasn't read them, please, I do urge you to read them. What was the driver? What did you want to explore? We'll take you first, Adele.
So mine is kind of less of a biography and more of a, I took a literary criticism approach to Anne's works. So I think in the first chapter, I kind of go through Anne's life because there are already lots of really good biographies out there about Anne. I really wanted to pull apart some of the misconceptions that people have. So like Nick just said, there's already a lot more really good critical work around Anne. You know, you look in Bronte studies and there's lots more people are taking her seriously. Since the 70s, a lot of feminists have looked at her work, Tennant in particular. On the kind of academic side, there's a lot of really good work on Anne, but the kind of general interest side, the social reputation that she has not quite caught up yet. I mean, it is now, but at the time that I started writing, it hadn't quite caught up. So there was this tension between the academic and the way that the public perceive her. So I really wanted to go through some of the myths around Anne, the biggest one that there are no myths about her. there's a book by Lucaster Miller called The Bronte Myth, and she says, I'm not really going to talk about Anne because nobody really talks about Anne. There aren't that many myths. And I think the biggest myth about Anne Bronte is that she's just not worth talking about. So I approached my book from a point of, what were the things that were important to Anne? Why was she writing about them? Why were maybe some of those things removed when Tennant was republished about 10 years later? And they did. They removed a whole chapter in which the protagonist's husband is being really jealous of the newborn baby. I know that they removed a lot of things to cut costs, but you look at a chapter like that and go, yeah, they've definitely removed this because people didn't enjoy it. So yeah, I really wanted to highlight the things that were important to Anne and what happened to her novels and her poetry after she died, to just kind of bridge that gap between the academic perception of her and the public perception.
Thank you, Adele. What about you, Nick?
Well, when I set out to write In Search of Anne Bronte, my first Anne book, it was about 2014, and we're heading towards the Bronte 200 period. 2016 was 200 years since Charlotte was born, and then we had Bramwell, and then Emily, and then 2020 Anne. And I thought it'd be great to have another Anne book. I'd read every Bronte biography by that time I could get my hands on. And I thought, I wish somebody would write a new one. And then I just thought, well, I could write it. I could try it anyway. So I got in touch with the publisher of a history press and said, you know, I'd like to write this book about Anne Bronte. Here's a sample chapter, an opening chapter that I just wrote. And they said, yeah, great, we love it. Let's do it. And that changed my life, really. I went from working in marketing to having a book out, and then people wanted me to write more books. And I went from being a Bronte fan to being a Bronte author, which was, you know, a lifelong dream, really, for me. And I get to do talks like this, which is amazing. But really, the aim of my book, yes, one was to put a new biography of Anne out there, but also it was to show the human side of Anne. And I think it's easy, with any literary biography, it's easy to read the books and enjoy them, which is brilliant. But sometimes it's hard to see the person. And especially with Anne and Emily, where there's not a lot of information out there, it's sometimes hard. You have to dig a little to find the person or to find what their life was like. And I wanted to put more of that in, so more of a social, historic background of the times, and try to imagine what Anne was thinking. And obviously that's an impossible task. You know, it's only my opinion. But I think if you're writing any biography of a historical figure, if you just present fact after fact after fact, it becomes like a shopping list. So I think you've got to have some creative license to put what your opinions are about it. And people might agree and they might not, and that's absolutely fine. But I think it's always good to try to flesh out the character or to make people think, what was life like for the Brontes in Howarth Parsonage or in Scarborough? And so that's what I wanted to do as well, put like a bit of the humanity back into the Bronte sister story, really.
She did very well. So Anne was the youngest of the sisters, and I wondered how much you thought her position in the family was a factor in how her siblings treated her, how she's perceived, and also a light that it might shine on her extraordinary resilience, which is part of the title of today's event. Who would like to respond to that?
Yeah, Anne, like I said, Anne was the youngest of six children. You know, once I went to a pub quiz, it will be relevant to this answer, honestly, and by coincidence, one of those, a Bronte question. And the question master said, it was a ridiculous question anyway. Who is the least famous Bronte sister? That was the question. So I had to put Anne. I wanted to win the quiz, so I knew that was the answer they were looking for. But of course, it's not true. It'd be, you know, the eldest sisters, Maria or Elizabeth, one of those. So there were six Bronte siblings, but people only remember three. Anne Branwell, you know, who is thankfully coming more into the spotlight as well. But the two oldest sisters get forgotten so easily. So yeah, so she was the youngest of six children, baby of a family, and when you're the youngest of six, then you are going to be treated in a way like a child, like a baby. You're going to be spoiled by all your older sisters and brother. And you get a glimpse of that in Agnes Grey, you know, where Agnes, who was the youngest surviving, only two surviving siblings in there, of six children, and she wants to be a governess, and they say, oh no, you can't do that. She wants to help around the house, go and play with the kitten, they say. And I think you get a glimpse there of what it must have been like for Anne, you know. She wanted to achieve so much. She was such an intelligent woman. But people were thinking, oh, no, her turn will come. And Patrick said that as well when the sisters went off to school. And he was right to a friend who had asked if Anne was going to school. He said, oh, no, I think we'll keep her at home for another year, you know. So I think she was always treated as the baby of a family, and even when she was an adult. And I think that informed her writing as well. She had to work harder to overcome that and say, look, here I am, and this is what I think.
Yeah, I agree. I was also going to mention the fact that Agnes in the novel is the youngest in her family, and she does complain a bit about being treated as the baby of the family and undermined. I think it kind of infantilized Anne a little bit. So you get, especially in Elizabeth Gaskell's biography, she talks about how Anne was the prettiest of the siblings. And then there are so many biographies that start their section on Anne with, she was the prettiest and the frailest of the Brontes. I don't think I've ever found a source for people saying that Anne had asthma or breathing difficulties all her life. You know, there are lots of letters where Charlotte writes about the winter and the weather affecting everyone in the parsonage and everyone getting very sick all the time. But for some reason, we only ever think of Anne as the smallest, the frailest, the most kind of susceptible to terrible colds and flu and things. But yeah, and there's a lot in Elizabeth Gaskell's biography that came from Charlotte's best friend, Ellen Nussey, her reminiscences. And she does talk about Anne being very shy, very quiet. Again, they focus on the fact that she was very pretty, very small, frail. Charlotte talking about Anne having a speech impediment or being so shy that she couldn't talk to strangers. And you think, well, she was the one who was employed for the longest. You know, she could clearly talk to strangers quite well.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a sense that somehow she was waiting to die, that underpinning everything she did. And obviously, they had more than their fair share of tragedy. And I think, but with that tragedy comes a resilience, because you have to be resilient. It's not like it's a one-off, that these were troubling times, these were difficult times, and for that family in particular. Do you think exposure to so much tragedy helped her develop a kind of resilience? So on the one hand, she was being infantilized, but on the other hand, this was a woman who was very, very strong and very, very determined. And I think it's you that said, Nick, that she was almost trying to prove a point that Charlotte and Emily might not be able to hold down a job, but hell, I'm going to give it the best shot and I'm going to keep on coming back for more. That is not a little kitten, is it? That is somebody who is, you know, she was not waiting to die. She had lots more oil in her can. So tell us a little bit about your research. You are looking very much at how Anne was edited. And without being too technical, I'm sure there's plenty of Shanty fans who would love you to be technical, but I'd love you to talk a little bit, because no one's really done very much work on the actual texts, the poems, and how those words have been manipulated. Can you tell us a little bit about the journey you've been on and what you've uncovered?
Even modern editors have to make their own choices as they're editing Anne's works, but I'm really interested in how they were initially edited. So Tennant went out of print, obviously. When it came back into print, lots of things have been removed. But even before that, Charlotte was editing some of Anne's work as well. So she edited Agnes Grey. The things that she edited in Agnes Grey, I think, were mostly just kind of superficial. So she's tried to go in and correct some of the things that the publisher, T.C. Newby, infamously made a mess of. Lots of spelling errors. The punctuation is all over the place. So Charlotte's gone in there and tried to fix some of that herself. She's not actually been that invasive. But when it came to poems that she chose to include in that edition, she's really focused on choosing very religious poems that Anne wrote. And she's also changed some of them to include even more religious references. So she's included lines about Moses in some of Anne's poetry. And then in the introduction, she compares Anne to Moses, you know, never quite saw the promised land. And she's making all these parallels. And I think, and also most famously, she edited Anne's last poem. So when Anne was given her diagnosis of tuberculosis, she started this really like sad, angry poem about coming to terms with the fact that she'd been given basically a death sentence based on what it did to her, you know, Emily and Branwell. And Charlotte reduced that. She got rid of 8 of the stanzas and she made it kind of about Anne's sadness at losing Emily rather than her own anger at receiving this diagnosis. And it's quite dramatic as well. So Charlotte says, I've given the last words of my sister Emily. It wasn't actually Emily's last poem, but she presented it as Emily's last poem. That's, you know, that's another conversation. And she presented this poem as Anne's last poem. The meaning of it has been completely changed. It makes it sound like she's fed up, she's waiting to die, she's so sad about losing Emily. But yeah, I think the inclusion of those poems, like very religious poems that she's then altered, was in response to maybe some critics calling Anne blasphemous because Anne had written about universal salvation, which at the time was quite a dangerous idea to have. And so Charlotte, I think, was really honing in on that and trying to say, she was just scared of going to hell. You know, look how religious she is. She's, you know, very serious. But I think that also did a lot of damage to the way that we see Anne.
You talk a lot in your book, Nick, about how upfront autobiographical Agnes Grey is. Do you want to talk us through, obviously the title of this event is Resilience and Reality, so I'd quite like you to give us your take on the reality of Agnes Grey.
Yes, I believe, firmly believe, although again it's only my opinion, that Agnes Grey, well, obviously it certainly has some relation to Anne's life in parts. There's no arguing about that. But it's to how much of it is. And I think it is, you know, largely, it's got a lot of autobiographical elements as far as I'm concerned. And I think most authors, most novelists do put themselves into the book if it's any good. Especially first books, I think a lot of them, like The Professor, which was Charlotte's first book, a lot of them are based on their own life experience or what they would have liked to happen in their lives or people they've met in lives. And I think Anne tells us that herself in a very first paragraph to Agnes Grey, which says, all true histories contain instruction. And then she goes on to say, shielded by my obscurity, a passage of years, and a few fictitious names I will not fear to venture. You know, she says, I'll set down what I wouldn't tell to my closest friends. And I think that's what she does. When she wrote Agnes Grey, she, you know, as far as she was concerned, she probably thought it might never get published. You know, people won't be talking about it 200 years later. I'm sure she wouldn't have thought that. So again, that was another barrier where she could talk about, especially about these two governess positions she'd had. And really, I think in a way, revenge might be a strong word, but I think it was a cathartic experience for her, where at last she could talk about her experience as a governess in Merfield with the Ingham family, who were, if we believe what we read in Agnes Grey and what we hear from other sources, from Charlotte, who said the Ingham children were desperate little dunces, that she had a really tough time being a governess there. And I think that's really explicitly spelled out in the book. We hear about Agnes teaching the, you know, her first set of children, the other Bloomfield children. And then later when she talks about the Murrays, which I believe very strongly were based on the Robinsons, a second family, who she was governess with for more than 5 years, it's a lot more, it's a nicer portrait. They're not cruel children in Agnes Grey. Agnes is infuriated by them, by their attitudes to love, particularly, and to society. But there's no bitterness, really, towards them. And again, in real life, I think that's what it was like with the Robinson children and Anne. You know, they really came to love their governess. They bought her a spaniel, Flossie. Years later, unfortunately, when Anne was dying of tuberculosis, they came to visit her, you know, in the snow in winter. And Charlotte wrote how delighted they were clinging onto their former governess. So I think there really was a close bond. And I think that comes through in the book. So I think the two governess episodes in the book really are in large parts drawn on her own experiences. But then there's a third section, really, a third main theme, I think, to Agnes Grey, which is the relationship, the love episode, which is a bit more problematic, the love episode with Weston, Reverend Weston. And again, I think, but I think it's at least partly because I want to think this, because I'm a romantic, sentimental fool, really, that Weston is based on Wakeman, yet sounds a bit like it to start with. And I think Anne certainly had a hope that something would happen between her and William Wakeman, who was the assistant curate in Haworth and who died tragically at a very early age. And that, I think, put an end to Anne's hopes for love. But she put it in the book, you know. She wanted to give herself, or Agnes, the love affair and the happy marriage that she couldn't have. So I think that part's not based on real life, but I think it's certainly, in my opinion, based on what she would have liked to happen, or just a dream, really.
At the end of your book, Adele, you say something along the lines of, the more you're incapable of speaking up for yourself, then others will do it for you. What was the pivot point in terms of the... Was it literally just waiting for societal change so that she could be viewed through a different, more contemporary prism? What was the pivot point in terms of people looking back at Anne? Because she wanted to be seen that. She felt that women were every bit as good a writer as a man. She was, you know, she was most comfortable with writing as a woman and being seen as a female writer. So she was trying to speak out. You talked about it being stifled earlier, but what let the genie out of the bottle good and proper? What was that pivot?
In the 1970s, people started returning to the Tenant of Wildfell Hall. In particular, there were a couple of papers written by G.D. Hargreaves, who's one of the heroes of my research. He restored the original text. It had been restored in the 1930s, but it was part of a really kind of special edition, limited edition of the Bronte's novels. But since 1854, no one had had access to this original full text of Tennant. And he brought a lot of attention to that. He edited an edition of Tennant in 1979. You've also got Winifred Guerin. I never know how to pronounce her name. The famous Bronte biography. She wrote a really flawed but lovely biography of Anne. And I think that was maybe the first time that anyone had been sympathetic like that towards her. So you've got Winifred Guerin, you've got G.D. Hargreaves saying, hang on a minute, Tennant isn't quite right, you know, we need to go back and look at this. And then obviously kind of new wave feminism and people looking again at the Brontes and also Anne this time and saying, actually, Agnes Grey is a really, really important novel about work and women who were, you know, Victorian women who had to work and whose only option in life was either to marry really well or be a governess. And then also kind of looking at Tennant and saying, Anne was looking at really serious issues in society that are still relevant today, really. But yeah, I think it was around the 1970s, especially particularly on an academic level, that people started to pay more attention to Anne. And I think as well, in a kind of more general sense, people have started to pay more attention to Anne, I think, since maybe the Bronte Bicentenaries. So with your book and Samantha Ellis's amazing book as well, and a lot of really, really good documentaries that came out around that time, people are starting to pay more attention to Anne, I think. So it's been a long process, but yeah.
And it can't have helped being published a lot in a volume with Wuthering Heights. That must have been quite an extraordinary, you know, thing for the public to deal with, because obviously they are very, very different books. Mm-hmm. It was a long time in coming, but we're delighted that it is. What role do you think the Bronte Parsonage Museum has in terms of how Anne is represented, and how important do you think having those physical artifacts as sort of portals into possibility and autobiographical interpretation?
I think it's vital. It's absolutely, Bronte Parsonage Museum is an amazing, amazing place. I think it's, I'm biased, but I think it's the best literary museum in the world, because it's got such a collection of physical things. And you go around and you see it. People are really moved, especially one of the items that's often on display is Anne's handkerchief, you know, with blood stains on it. And it's so moving. Or Charlotte's baby bonnet, that's another, such moving artifacts. But the everyday things as well, you know, the clothing they wore, slippers, spectacles, the books they read. And now we've got the dining table with an E scratched on it that Emily might have done. It seems possible. And really, I think that tells us just as much about the Brontes as reading their books, because, you know, you get to feel what life must have been like in that parsonage. When Anne was there, when the Brontes were there, it was very different, of course. It was cold. It wasn't full of tourists, so that's a big difference to start with. And Haworth was hugely different. It was one of the... Now it's an absolutely beautiful tourist village. And then it was one of the deadliest places in England. You know, people were dying very young. The Brontes, most of them died in the late 20s, early 30s. But back then, that was quite a good innings for Haworth. You know, people died a lot younger than that. So really, I think when we look around the parsonage and see the artifacts, it really does allow us to think, you know, these items are what were touched by Anne's hand. This is a handkerchief that Anne used when she was coughing with tuberculosis. And I think it's vital that we still see those artifacts. And they have a difficulty, I suppose, at the parsonage. They've got such a huge collection now. And a lot of the items are frail, so they can't be displayed. A lot are in storage because we've got so much. But they change things every year, which is brilliant. But I'd still personally like to see more Anne items there. You know, Charlotte dominates. In a way, it's because we've got more Charlotte items and she lived longer. We've got more things that belong to her. But I'd like to see more Anne items on display other than just the handkerchiefs. Oh, Anne died young. Wasn't she tragic? Which it was. But I'd like to see more emphasis about the happy years that she had in the parsonage as well.
I agree with what you said earlier, actually, about how it's really easy to forget that they're real people. You do this with any historical figure, and especially writers that people get very attached to. It's very easy to see them in a very kind of flat, this is what they were kind of way, or forget that they were real people. And the parsonage is so good at reminding you that they actually lived here. They, you know, you can have a look at Emily's diary paper about them sat in the kitchen, and you can actually go see that kitchen where they would have sat to write their, you know, tiny books and things. And I agree that I would like to see more Anne things, but again, they don't have as many Anne things as they do Charlotte and Emily. The Anne Bronte Bicentenary exhibition was amazing. It was so wonderful. I didn't know that they had as much as they did. It was really nice to see some of her poetry manuscripts. And I think they also had a tiny book that Charlotte had written for Anne when she was a little girl. But you just kind of get this really lovely sense of how close the family was, the collaboration between them. Because there's this really lovely miniature book that Charlotte writes for her little sister, and it's adorable, you know. And when you think of the Brontes, you think of them maybe, you know, writing a masterpiece by themselves in the dining room. But actually, they were, you know, they were this really close-knit family, and I think the Bronte Parsonage is really good at getting that across.
So returning to the subject of resilience, what did Anne draw upon? I mean, was it faith, family, poetry, writing? ambition, love of animals, combination of all, more, none of the above. Where did she get that resilience? Because she was resilient, despite her tragic end. Nick, do you want to?
Yes, you're right. I think out of all the Brontes, in my opinion, Anne was the most resilient. And one way we can give evidence for that is, yeah, that she worked a lot longer. Their sisters did. Emily had a short stint as a teacher, and Charlotte had short stints as a teacher and a governess. But Anne held down a job for more than 5 years and was really valued and loved by the people she worked with. So I think she had resilience and strength there. And we see in her last months as well, you know, we hear from Charlotte's letter about Emily when she was dying. She wouldn't take any medicine. She said it was all quackery, which to be fair, it was, but she didn't know that people at the time thought these remedies actually worked. But she wouldn't take any, and she wouldn't do anything to change her routine. You know, she carried on getting up and trying to brush her own hair until she couldn't do it anymore on the day she died. But Anne wasn't like that. She wanted to live, I think. You know, she took the medicines in her final weeks. You know, she said, I want to go to Scarborough, where she'd been many times as a governess. And it had a spa there, which meant to have healing waters. And I honestly think she thought, if I get to Scarborough, you know, I'm very weak now, but the waters might give him more strength. Yes, she was going to die. She'd been diagnosed with terminal consumption tuberculosis. But some people with that diagnosis still lived for a number of years afterwards. So I think she wanted to carry on, and she got that strength to say, come on, let's try. Let's try to get better. Let's try to carry on. And I think she'd got plans for further books. I'm sure she must have. She got a lot more to say, and she didn't give in, you know. She wouldn't be the archetypal youngest sister. She wouldn't be the baby of the family. She wanted to tell people what she thought about women's conditions, about work for middle-class people, middle-class women at the time, about, you know, marital abuse, which is an amazing, such a powerful thing to do in, you know, the 1840s, and it's still powerful today. So she got so much to say, but she wouldn't keep quiet. And she says that as well in Agnes Grey and in her preface to the second edition of The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. Said, when I've got a truth to speak, even if it be unpalatable, even if, you know, it'd be hard for people to hear, even if it damages my own reputation, you know, I'm going to say it. And that's a hugely powerful thing to do.
Yeah, I'd agree with all of that. And I think she was very, very motivated by telling the truth and bringing injustice to light. And her final letter to Ellen Nussey, when she was asking Ellen to come with them to Scarborough, she says that she's got lots of plans and she really wants to do some good in the world. And I think that was what motivated her. She wanted to do some good in the world, and she had lots of plans, obviously, that she was never able to follow through with. But I think, yeah, in the preface to The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, she does talk a lot about exposing the truth and kind of talking for people who maybe can't speak for themselves. And she includes a lot in there about animal rights and rights for women, and just the way she was very passionate about education. I think she was very passionate about a lot of things, and that drove her as well.
Do you think there was much competition between the siblings? Do you think there was any jealousy, rivalry, competition? Was it just the normal healthy banter that you would have in a family, or was there a little bit more to it? Again, I know this is delving into the nether territory of supposition, but let's go there.
I think, so my research, obviously, Charlotte never comes out looking very good. And whenever I go to a conference or anything, I always preface it with, this is not about bashing Charlotte. I think it came from a really good place. And what we have to remember is she'd lost three of her siblings within a year. And she was writing to her friends and saying, this work is so painful, going through all of their things. And she was dealing with, you know, she had her own reputation to think about as well, but she also wanted to make sure that people knew who they were. I think Charlotte also had a really strong sense of injustice, and she was trying to fix something there. As for rivalry, I think it was just kind of standard sibling, you know, as the oldest of three, I'm very guilty of kind of seeing my younger brothers as a lot younger than they actually are. I don't think, personally, I don't think there was ever any malice. I mean, I know there are quotes about Charlotte saying, what was it, like, Anne is nothing, or I can't remember the context for that. But again, you know, she was what, maybe 12, 13 years old writing these things. I think we can't look at them as, you know, flat, two-dimensional people. We've got to remember they were from a very close-knit family. They did socialise more than we think they did, but still there weren't really any other children their own age. I think it was just, if they had been as competitive as people maybe want to think of them, I don't think we'd have the works that they've written. I don't think they would have been as collaborative.
Would you agree with that, Nick?
I would, yeah. And that's one of the things where I've changed my mind ever so slightly from when I wrote In Search of Anne Bronte. Seen that, and I certainly didn't mean it to come out like that, but when I read it back myself, I thought, it does come across as a bit of Charlotte bashing. And I think I said in the book, you know, I think there was sibling rivalry, but there's sibling rivalry in every family. That's part of being human, isn't it? So I don't think Charlotte was jealous of Anne in that sense. But yes, it is easy when you look at the way Charlotte stopped Tennant of Wildfell Hall being republished and her biographical notes where she says Anne and Emily were uneducated and they weren't, they were just as educated as Charlotte was. It's easy to think, oh, yeah, Charlotte's really putting her sisters down. But I do think it was from a place of love, really. She was trying to protect their reputation. And she obviously did love Anne. You know, after Anne had died, when she wrote her elegy to Anne on the death of Anne Bronte, she was the darling of my life. And I think they were really close. I think she really cared about Anne. But yeah, I think there were rivalries, just as a normal family. Branwell, we can look at on that score where he later on said that Anne was nothing. But Branwell had got his own problems, you know, and he was dealing with them. And earlier in his life, when Anne was an eight-year-old, he'd drawn this lovely fairy tale castle for her. So I think they were really close as children. And Branwell, unfortunately, and Charlotte to an extent may have drifted away a little bit later on as they went on with their own adult lives. But no, I don't think there was a real angry rivalry between them.
Before we open this up to questions, you must get asked all the time by people who perhaps haven't read any of Anne's work. What would you both say to somebody, proselytising aside, about why they should read one of Anne Bronte's books, and if so, which
That's
one?
That's really difficult. the choosing which one, not why they should
No,
read
just
them,
do the why then.
Yeah, her voice is really modern, especially in Agnes Grey. It's, you know, you think of classic literature and you think of really difficult things to read, but Agnes Grey especially is very, very easy to read. And it's a lot of fun. And I think people also forget that Anne Bronte was very funny. You know, there's lines in this, like Rosalie Murray and Matilda are talking about a ball, and Rosalie is saying to her sister, "Wasn't I beautiful, Matilda? You know, I was amazing." And Matilda just goes, "Middling." And that, you know, that... I love stuff like that, and things where, like, Helen is talking to her aunt in The Tenant of Wildfell Hall about the Bible, and her aunt is horrified at what Helen is saying. And she says to her, "Where have you been reading all of this, Helen?" And she goes, "In my Bible, aunt." And that just, it makes me think of the diary paper where their aunt is saying, "Where are your feet, Anne? On the floor, aunt," or something like that. And it's just that kind of very dry humour. Things like in The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, there's Gilbert's younger brother, teenage brother, is hilarious. You know, he's just this very sullen teenager who thinks, "Oh, I've got to go in the field again," kind of thing. And yeah, there is a lot of humour in Anne's books. And it's not just, you know, Charlotte wrote in the biographical notice that Anne hated her work but would pursue it, you know, in this kind of, "I want to teach people, I want to moralise." They're not moralising, they're very human, they're very, I think they're still very relatable and very easy to read even now.
My favourite book of all time is Wuthering Heights. I mean, I used to talk about it, but I love that. But I think Anne's books are really up there. They deserve to be in the top, in the Premier League, really, of novels of the 19th century, any century. And I especially love Agnes Grey. Because it's a short book, it's so easy to read, like Adele said. You can whiz through it, and it's really enjoyable. Even if it's got some hard-hitting moments, especially with the Ingham children, you know, killing birds, ripping wings off, horrible things like that. But it's got a lot of humour in there as well. And it's a really human story. You get to the end, 150 pages in my edition, and then Anne says, Agnes, you know, Anne writing as Agnes, says, "Oh, now I think I've said sufficient," and that's it. You know, she's a brilliant end to the book, I think. So she's really good to read. And I think she's a really important novelist. You know, they say about The Tenant, when Helen slams her door against her husband, you know, said it reverberated throughout the 19th century. And women and wives are still having those problems today, unfortunately, around the world. And it's still, Anne's still giving that same message, you know. Stand up for your own rights. Don't live in a loveless marriage. Don't be abused. you know, be strong. And I think that's such an important message today. So they are really important books, but they're really enjoyable books as well. And that's a really, you know, it's a winning combination, I think.
It is indeed. Right. Well, I'm sure there's lots of questions that our audience would like to ask. Who would like to start?
There's a lot of talk about Bramwell being the inspiration behind the alcoholic, you know, Huntington in Tennant. Do you think, either of you, that it was based on him or the conversations you'd had with previous domestic abuse victims?
I think there's part of Bramwell in it. I mean, yep, there's no getting away from the fact that he, in later life, he was addicted to alcohol and addicted to drugs. And he fought bravely against them, but fortunately, you know, in the end, he couldn't defeat them. So Anne did see firsthand the effect of an alcoholic in the house. You know, Patrick had to move him into his bedroom. You know, Bramwell threatened to shoot Patrick or said, in the morning, one of us will be dead, things like that. But I wanted to stick up for Bramwell as well. You know, he was battling his demons. And he could be, you know, such a eloquent and intelligent, obviously was a really intelligent man as well. And people knew him, like his friend Francis Grundy said, you know, he was no domestic demon. He was just a man moving in a fog who lost his way, which I think is a nice way to put it. But there was no getting away from the fact that Anne and the people in the parsonage saw the downside of an alcoholic living in close proximity. So I definitely think some of the episodes as to how an alcoholic behaves and how people behave when they're completely drunk and unreasonable, she'd have seen that firsthand from Bramwell. But I don't think Bramwell completely is Huntington, from a different social class to start with, and Huntington's not really got any redeeming features at all. And I don't think that's Bramwell. I think she had experiences maybe at, you know, in York as well, at Thorpe Green Hall with the Robinson family. I think the husband there, the master of the house, was a bit of an angry, choleric drunkard a lot of the time. I think she'd seen things there that, you know, when she'd said, I've had experiences of human behaviour that were just awful. And I think that a lot of that goes into the book as well. So I think it's partly Bramwell, if I sum it up in a sentence, but not all.
Yeah, I agree. I think if anybody in Tennant is like Bramwell, I'd say it's more Lord Loughborough, the one that she kind of is a bit more sympathetic to, tries to get sober, tries to stay away from his horrible friends, gets pulled back in. By the end of it, he's fine, you know. Well, I say fine, but his wife has obviously left him. But he's moved away from his horrible friends and is kind of improving and working on himself. But yeah, I agree. We can't just look at all of the Brontes' horrible characters and say that's Bramwell, because yeah.
Thank you. I agree with you about the humour, and I always think of Agnes Grey as being, partly because of her position, passive aggressive, but in a witty sort of way, you know, and that comes across. But what I was going to ask, I think Lucas de Millen makes the point that with the Brontes, the public are actually more interested in the lives than the work, compared with Charles Dickens or somebody like that. And I think we have to agree with that. And I wondered if you thought that was actually a problem or if it's okay.
I wouldn't call it a problem. I think it's really, really interesting that they have become so famous. You know, there are lots of people who are maybe Bronte fans who haven't read the books. They just think that they're incredibly interesting people to learn about, which I think is amazing in itself. And I think a lot of that started because they were initially anonymous. You know, you've got three people publishing under male pseudonyms. People thought that they were all one person, the Bells, or it was, you know, one person using three different pseudonyms to write books. There's always been an air of mystery around the Brontes ever since they first published. And I think that's just, you know, the fascination has continued as their story has unfolded and we learn more about them. But I think it's really good. You know, if someone comes to the Bronte Parsonage Museum and they just want to learn more about their lives and then they go away and read all the books, that's amazing.
I agree again. I think the Bronte story, the Bronte family, the life story is so amazing. The books are amazing, but the life story is just as amazing that, you know, get three sisters from one family. And not an upper-class family. You know, they had to work for a living. They didn't have a lot of money behind them like some novelists did. And somehow three of them have written such amazing books, all amazing. And that's an incredible story. And then you get the tragic element to it, that they died so young. And when you put those things together, it's like the best episode of EastEnders ever, I think. It's just a brilliant story. So and I think, to a lot of people go to a parsonage who haven't necessarily read the books. Remember once I asked a volunteer, what's the most common questions you get asked from people coming in? And they said, unfortunately, there were two. Is this where Jane Austen lived? which Bronte wrote Pride and Prejudice. But so we don't necessarily know all the books, but we're still very fascinated by the story. And I think that can only be a good thing, because then maybe we'll go away and read Jane Eyre or Agnes Grey.
Talking of Jane Eyre, George Moore said in the 1920s that he compared Agnes Grey with the best of Jane Austen's writing. And he said that if Anne Bronte had lived another 10 years, she would be as famous as Jane Austen and possibly more so. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's... I mean, I'm biased. I love Anne Bronte and her writing. But, well, I like Jane Austen as well. But yeah, I think it's true. And unfortunately, we'll never know, because she only managed to get two novels, but they're both brilliant. And as she said in a letter to Ellen Lucy, she'd got plans, and I'm sure they must have involved other novels. And it's a pity she didn't live longer. But she got, like Jane Austen, she got the two great characteristics that she had. Again, we think, oh, romance. That's the first thing that comes to mind when you think Jane Austen. But really, they've got a lot of satire and a lot of humour in them. And I think Anne Bronte had got that as well. So I think she could have been on the same level as Jane Austen. And I think she should be remembered that way now. Again, I do think there's still a tendency by people to think, oh, there's Charlotte and Emily right up at the top and Anne maybe lower down. But I think she deserves to be on that top shelf as well, really.
Yeah, they all do.
No, I agree.
I think what makes Anne so great for me is that she lived by her own principles. They were very strong, and she didn't just write stories. She wrote what she felt.
Yeah, I agree, and that's part of her power that, like I said, she was obsessed in a good way with the truth. She wouldn't have been interested in writing a science fiction novel, for example, not that they had them in those days. But she wanted to put an element of truth in her books as well. It's really important to her. And I think that's why they're so relevant today, really.
Yeah, I think she was very, very observant and incredibly good at writing very believable characters. Her characterisation is really, really strong, I think.
Can I ask you, in what way was Winifred Guerin flawed?
So we've talked a lot about how Agnes Grey, Anne pulled a lot of things from her own life. Winifred Guerin kind of takes a lot of Agnes Grey incredibly literally, even down to saying, well, Anne must have travelled to her first governess role on this day at this time based on Agnes Grey. She really does rely very heavily on using Agnes Grey as a straight biographical resource. I love the Winifred Guerin biography because it is so sympathetic towards Anne, but I think she did lean a bit too hard on using Agnes Grey as like a biographical source.
Thank you both for this talk. It was really refreshing. I just wanted to ask, at the risk of sounding like falling into the stereotype of moralising, there's been like critical analysis of Helen's diary as like conduct lit, and I wondered if maybe instead of viewing Agnes Grey as like purely autobiographical, whether a case could be made for viewing it as conduct lit as well.
I've read some really interesting analysis of Agnes Grey as maybe Anne's own attempt at kind of writing a sermon, because there's a huge section in Agnes Grey where Agnes is talking to one of the characters called Nancy Brown, and Nancy Brown is kind of having a religious crisis of her own. You know, she's quite old, she's struggling to get to church. The rector is kind of making fun of her and saying, you need to be in church, because how are you going to know how to worship properly if you don't come to church? And then there's a whole conversation there with Agnes where she's kind of saying, she's criticising, I think, a lot of members of the clergy who just kind of took the job for the money and then didn't care about their parishioners. So, yeah, there's a lot of that in there. It is quite instructional in places, especially with how Agnes approaches being a governess as well. But it's also kind of cleverly disguised as just this really lovely, enjoyable story that you don't realise you're kind of learning things.
I agree as well. I mean, again, it's that first line, all true histories contain instruction. And I think that was always at the front of Anne's mind. And it was a really brave thing to do in both her novels. She talks about religion, and she's a clergyman's daughter herself. And people, it's hard looking back as we are today, even people who go to church or see themselves as religious. I don't think religion dominates their lives as much as it did a lot of people in the 19th century. So it was really brave of Anne, like in Agnes Grey, to show her, you know, a corrupt vicar, really, somebody who's only in it for position and power. And then in The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, where she talks about people being redeemed, where, you know, when you die, if you've been evil, you don't just go to hell. But that's what people thought at the time. It was prevailing, you know, philosophy, really, that if you died, there was no hope for you. unless you're one of the elect. And of course, all the priests and the people who were the upper echelons of society all saw themselves as the elect, so they could do what they wanted. And there was no hope for poor people who'd made a sin. So it's really brave of Anne to say, no, I don't believe in this. I believe in salvation. And I think that's in both her books, saying to people, look, this is how I think you should be living your life. This is what I think religion and God is. And it was a controversial thing for her to do.
Would you say it's fair then to describe Anne as a lion, not a kitten?
Absolutely, yes. She's the chief lioness of the Bronte family, I think. And she's still roaring today, you know. We're here in 2024 in Bradford, the home city of the Brontes, talking about her. And, you know, when she died 175 years ago, people would have thought, oh, in a year's time, nobody will know that name, but we do.
Before we close, what is the most astonishing, interesting, fun thing you've uncovered about Anne in your many hours of researching and reading?
Again,
doesn't
that's
have to
very...
be groundbreaking. It's just something that right now piques your interest.
I like how much she enjoyed music. We always think of Emily as maybe the musical member of the family, but Anne had her own music book and she would copy out hymns that she enjoyed, and she had a go at writing her own as well. Yeah, music played quite a huge part in the Bronte family, as did all art. You know, the Brontes all had art lessons, and I really enjoy Anne Bronte's art. You know, that's one of her sketches on here. But yeah, I think it's really lovely to think of them enjoying music and art.
I agree, and I'll just very briefly pop on to Emily, because one of the things that fascinated me about my research was a letter Ellen Nussey wrote to Elizabeth Gaskell, giving her more information about Emily Bronte. And we think of Emily particularly as being very shy, which I think she was, and a bit strange. People might say, you know, Charlotte said she'd just stand there silent sometimes. But Ellen paints a slightly different picture. And she said she loved nothing more than taking Charlotte onto the moors. Charlotte was scared of wild animals, Ellen says. And she'd take Charlotte onto the moors and lead her close to where she knew some wild animals were, then scare her by showing her these wild animals, then just laughing uproariously. So that's a nice side of Emily to see. But she loved playing practical jokes on people. So that's Emily. And with Anne, I think just the strange stories that exist about, like, her ghost that's in Brooklyn in New York. Apparently, she was a governess at Blake Hall near Murfield, only for a few months. The house was demolished in the 50s and sold off, and the grand staircase got shipped somehow to Long Island, I think, in New York, and put in this grand hall. And the woman who lived there said she saw a ghost coming down the staircase and told her it was Anne Bronte. So I don't know why I had a ground up a staircase all these years, but
that's a beautiful note to end. Just watch out when you leave the staircase this afternoon. Adele and Nick, thank you very much for a wonderful, wonderful session. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. And thank you to everyone who attended our 2025 Bradford Literature Festival and helped to make it such a success. You'll be able to listen back to some of our selected events in the new series, coming soon.